Well, we've seen over these past two Lord's days that the prophet Obadiah is speaking to the Edomites. He's spoken to them about their pride, their arrogance, even in the face of God, that there they were in their strongholds in the mountains, and they thought that they were invincible. And they looked down into the lowlands of Judah, and they laughed to scorn the remnants of Judah, for most of that land had been ransacked, and the people taken into captivity in Babylon. And here were this haughty people who mocked God's people, and by doing so mocked God himself. And this prophet, by the command of God, spoke to these Edomites and warned them that this attitude of pride and arrogance would lead them to destruction, and that they were on the brink of disaster. And in that second section then, the prophet went on to describe what they had done to the people of Judah, how they had looked on as their enemies have swept over the land, how they had even stood in the valleys and in the ravines of the mountains and captured any who had tried to escape from the Babylonians. And God warned these people then that their own actions would come back to haunt them, that their own dead would lie in the ravines, that any who tried to flee would be captured and cut off, that their possessions would be stolen and their strongholds would be overrun, that there would be no place for them to hide, that God was coming and he would bring them low, he would bring them to destruction. And then in this final section of the prophecy, Obadiah goes on to describe a great change that's going to take place in Judah. That there was going to be a whole reversal of the fortunes of Judah and of Esau. A great turning point was going to come when the plight of Judah would be turned around, and the prosperity of Esau would be brought to nothing. And it's described for us in, particularly in verses 17 and 18. On Mount Zion there shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness. The house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau shall be stubble. They shall kindle them and devour them. And no survivor shall remain of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. Obadiah reiterates that Esau is going to be destroyed. Those who once boasted in their mountain strongholds were going to be brought to nothing. And Israel would be restored. The people of Judah would be brought back to their possessions. Those who once were captives, those who once sang songs of lament in Babylon and longed for Jerusalem, would be brought back. And what's more, the tables would be turned, and those who once laughed their brothers to scorn would find themselves judged by their brothers. That those who once brought destruction on their brothers by doing nothing to stop their enemies would find destruction coming on themselves from the hands of their brothers. God pictures Jacob, that is the two tribes of Judah in the south, and the house of Joseph, representing the northern 10 tribes of Israel, as being flames, as being fires that will come to Esau and devour him. They'll kindle him, and all that will remain is blackened stubble. There'll be nothing there. And this fire represents, of course, the judgment of God, as it so often does throughout the scriptures. God is going to come in judgment against Esau, against the Edomites, against this people who have mocked him, who have turned their backs on him and upon his chosen people. Where once man thought he dominated, God will be acknowledged as sovereign. The kingdom, we're told at the end of the chapter, shall be the Lord's. Not the Edomites, not the descendants of Esau. It won't be their kingdom. It will be the Lord's kingdom. He will be sovereign. He will be God. Where wickedness once abounded, where brother turned against brother, holiness will prevail. On Mount Zion there shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness. Two things are represented here. There's the wickedness of Esau, who have come into Judah, who have ransacked the city of Jerusalem, and who have taken whatever possessions had been left by the Babylonians, and the wickedness of all those hostile activities of the Edomites, that's represented there. But also the reason behind the exile of the people of Judah. Why are they in Babylon? Why are they captive now to the Babylonians? Well, it's because they turned their backs on God. They worshipped false gods. They didn't uphold the law of God. Holiness had left the promised land, and wickedness had taken its place. But God says this will change. God says he will bring deliverance to the people of Judah, and he will restore holiness to their land. God's going to do this work. For what was lost through disobedience is going to be regained through grace. What these people had lost through their rebellion against God, God would restore to them. Not because they deserve it. Not because they've changed and have made up for their wickedness. But because in his grace, in his mercy, God is going to show favor towards these people. And he's going to keep his promise that he made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, that there would be an eternal kingdom here, and that from Abraham's seed would rise up one who would bless the nations, and that on the throne of David would sit an eternal king. God's at work here. And his grace is evident in the midst of these sad, distressing, lamentable circumstances. And Obadiah is warning the people of Edom. God hasn't left his people. God hasn't forgotten his people. Things may seem bleak for them, and you may be priding yourself in having forsaken this God of your forefathers and taken things into your own hands. But God will work, and God will fulfill his promises. So great changes will take place in Judah and in Edom. Another thing to note here is that this is a recurring theme throughout the scriptures. This isn't something new that's happening here. It's happened before, and it will happen again. It happened to Joseph, didn't it? Joseph there, taken by his brothers, captive, pushed into a pit, and then sold into slavery. Joseph who went through those awful, awful circumstances. For a moment, things seemed to be getting better as he spent that time in Potiphar's house and seemed to do so well and rose to a position of authority there. And then everything came crashing down once again. And he finds himself in the king's prison. But things got better again. And God turned those evil, wicked actions of his brothers for good. And Joseph became their savior. And he gave them the opportunity to be saved from famine and be saved from destruction. Israel itself there, years later, in Egypt still, now grown to a nation in its own right. But slaves, the people of Egypt have forgotten what Joseph had done. The people of Egypt enslaved Israel. But again, God came and brought them out of their captivity. And there was that great exodus from Egypt to the promised land. And now these people of Judah have been taken from the promised land back into captivity once again. But God is going to bring them out of their captivity. And he's going to bring them back into their land. And he's going to bless them despite the evil that has overtaken them. And he's going to restore them despite their previous waywardness. This is a recurring theme of bad things happening to the people of God, all in God's plan and purpose, and his eventual restoration and exaltation of his people. It's a theme that the psalmist picks up in Psalm 73. Remember how the psalmist lamented the fact that the wicked always seem to do so well. He says, "My feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." And he goes on to describe how the wicked seem to do so well. Nothing seems to hurt them. Whatever they do seems to prosper, though they trample on other people, though they ignore God. Worse, they laugh at God and say, "Who is he? Where is he? He's got nothing to do with us." And they seem to do so well. And here he is. He's tried to live a godly life. He's tried to do what's right. And it seems as though God is constantly chastening him. Seems as though nothing goes well for him. Seems as though everything is against him. And he begins to wonder, is it worth it all? Is it worth following God when this is the result? When the wicked prosper and the godly seem to perish? But then we're told how the psalmist pondered these things and approached God and consulted him about them. And God revealed to him that while it might be the case at the present time that the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper, there is coming a day when God will reward the righteous and the wicked will perish. It's a theme taken up again in the New Testament, particularly in Luke chapter 16 and in that story that Jesus gives of the rich man and Lazarus. Remember how there were these two men and both of them in the same night died. And the poor beggar Lazarus is taken into heaven and the rich man descends into hell. And there's this conversation then between the rich man and Abraham as he asks to go back to his brothers to warn them of this awful destiny that awaits them if they continue in their wickedness, in their rebellion against God, in their refusal to walk in God's ways. And Abraham tells this man, "Well, you had your good things in this life and now you're suffering." And Lazarus, well, he endured evil things. And now he is rewarded for his faithfulness to God. And we may feel the same way. In our lives, we may feel like the psalmist. We may feel like Lazarus. We may feel as though everything's against us. The whole world is arrayed against us. And everything that we do and every choice that we make that seems consistent with God's will brings us trouble, brings us more heartache, brings us more pain. And we really need to remember these stories from the Bible of Joseph, of Israel, of Judah, of the rich man and Lazarus, of the psalmist in his musings. We need to remember that God is God still. He may seem far off, but really he's very much present and working in these circumstances, confirming the wicked in their wickedness and helping the righteous in their path to godliness. This is God's way. Exactly why it is God's way, we don't understand. Why doesn't God simply clear things up in a moment, sort everything out in a millisecond? He could. Why doesn't he? Who knows? God has his purposes. He has his ways that are not always revealed to us. But notice in this prophecy some spiritual truths that we can take to heart. For here we have a number of themes that can help us to appreciate that God is at work in our lives and that God is working out his eternal purposes in this world, despite the way things may appear to us. God told the Edomites through Obadiah that on Mount Zion there shall be deliverance. Not in the mountains of Edom. Not in Mount Seir. That's where they put their hope. They put their hope in their strongholds. They put their hope in their strength, in their wisdom, in their abilities. But God says, Mount Zion, that's where there will be deliverance. On that small hill in Judah, that's where deliverance is going to come from. In that place that's been overrun by its enemies. In that place that's been desecrated by the wicked idolaters of the world. That's where deliverance is going from. That place that seems so weak and insignificant. For that is the place that God chose Jesus Christ to come and to bear the sins of his people. That place, Zion, Jerusalem, on a hill there, the Son of Man gave up his life to deliver his people from their sins. In that place, those who were under God's conviction for their sin and disobedience would be brought by grace to adoption in his family. Zion, the place of deliverance, the place of holiness, a place that's been desecrated, but a place that will be restored. For as the hearts of God's people was turned towards wickedness, so through his grace, it will be restored to holiness. God is at work. And God's judgment will come against those who refuse him, those who turn their backs on him. And God's fire will fall and it will kindle them and devour them until there is nothing left. And this is the picture that we get so vividly portrayed in some of the lessons of Jesus Christ himself and in the book of Revelation. that there will be this eternal place where the fire is never quenched, where the worm never dies, where the wicked will be eternally destroyed. And we're told that this kingdom shall be the Lord's. This world will be the Lord's. That's the way the book of Revelation puts it in Revelation chapter 11. And in verse 15, we're told that there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." There's coming a time when every knee shall bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. That there will be no people like the people of Edom, who in their own pride and arrogance say, "Where is God? Who shall bring us down from our high and lofty place?" For God will be on his throne in heaven, and every tongue will confess that he is Lord. There will be no one else who will claim sovereignty. There will be no kingdom of earth that will take arms against him. All will be destroyed and all will be renewed. And there will be a new heavens and a new earth. And Jesus Christ will reign with his people. And the kingdom shall be the Lord's. And that's what Peter encouraged those recipients of his letter within 2 Peter chapter 3. He says, "The day of the Lord is coming as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up." But there's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. And in that new earth, righteousness will dwell. So, in conclusion, this prophecy of Obadiah is a warning against all unbelievers, all who resist the Lord and turn their backs upon him. For they are pictured in the people of Edom. They think that they can do things themselves. They think that strength lies in their own works. They think that by their own ingenuity, by their own wisdom, they can succeed. They think that in their own understanding, there is peace. But God says no. There is only peace in God. And there is only security in the Lord. And God will destroy the people of Edom. And he will destroy all people today who live as the Edomites lived and refuse to turn to the Lord and to obey him. It's a great warning to such people. And it's a great comfort to those represented by the people of Judah here, who may feel as though everything's against them, who may feel as though they're in captivity, that God will restore them. That there is coming a day when wickedness will be banished, when righteousness will reign, when the people of God will be with God in his paradise and will be freed from all the trials and the pains and the difficulties that are so prevalent in this world. And the question then for you is, where do you fall? Are you like the Edomites? Or are you like the people of Judah? Are you a Christian? One who has truly put their faith in Jesus Christ? Who seeks to live in godliness before Jesus and in Jesus' strength? Are you one who pursues those things that are pleasing to God, despite any difficulties that that might bring in this world? Or are you one who looks for the easy way, who chooses things according to how much pleasure it will bring, how much comfort it will afford? Do you follow God or follow your own wisdom? That's the question. And depending on your answer is eternity. An eternity in hell's fires and the judgment and wrath of God, or eternity in a new earth where God is pleased with his people and blesses them forever.